You're listening to a UC San Diego podcast.
Okay. How's it going? Assignment one is over. The time for the conferring of the prizes has come. I know we're all excited for the award ceremony, so I hope no one lost too much sleep last night. There seems to be a very, very negative correlation between people doing well on the assignment and showing up to collect their prizes. So no one in the undergraduate class collected their awards. The prizes are a can of Red Bull, 5-hour energy extra strength strawberry watermelon flavor. I've never tried this one. And Sour Patch Kids Extreme. So if you're a winner, you may choose one of these prizes, assuming you showed up to class. So is the Dark Knight here? Yes, would you like to claim a prize? You have the option of not claiming one too. Anything you want. Congratulations. Okay, that's task one. Also, Ren Zhang was the winner in the undergrad class. I don't know if he's showing up to these classes instead. Guess he's asleep. Okay. And for rating prediction, there really wasn't much in it. It was down to the third decimal place. So the winner is the Data Musketeer. Are you here? I guess not. Or you prefer to remain anonymous. That's fine too. Certainly a lot of people were worried that they hadn't beaten the baseline, so don't worry about the user who has the username baseline. That is not the baseline. The baseline is right down here. So 6771 is the baseline. All but a few people beat it. If your score is something like this, then let us know what happened. Like, obviously, this is not a conceptual error, but you divided by zero or something, so let us know and we can be flexible. Okay. So, glad to see just about everyone made it to class, and that you didn't lose too much sleep over that. I hope reports are all submitted by now. I think things look pretty good. I was certainly worried that there'd be some weird outlier review in the private test set that got out of equal to a million and helpful equals to zero. Seems that didn't happen too much. Okay, so back to social networks, and then at the end of the class I should talk about a few examples of really good assignment twos that people did last year that you might want to try and emulate. On Monday we started talking about random models of graphs. Okay? So we wanted to try and come up with a model of random graph formation that somehow looked like real-world human social networks. And the first way we tried to do this was just by throwing down a bunch of nodes and then throwing down a bunch of edges completely at random, as if you showed it to Facebook and just chose completely random people to be friends with. Now, of course, you know that's kind of not going to be a realistic-looking social network. That's not how people form social connections. But it's an interesting first model to study because we can actually analyze it and say, well, if it's not realistic, what is it about this network that is particularly unrealistic? And we found a few things that are unrealistic about it. One is, well, maybe it seems to have these really long paths, like there's no close connection between these two people. But we said real-world social networks form small worlds. There are these short paths between people through their social connections. Something else we saw was this idea of a power law degree distribution. We saw that, you know, real graphs have degree distributions that look like this, but this type of graph has a degree distribution that looks like this. So somehow it's not realistic. In a real social network, we see a small number of people with really high degree and lots of people who have to sort of share the rest of the friendships amongst themselves, so the one percenters and the rest of us. Whereas this random graph model didn't exhibit that sort of realistic property. So we came up with a more complicated random graph model, which does exhibit this property. This was designed as a way of randomly generating something that would look like the web graph. So the idea was to do this. You just lay down a bunch of web pages. Every web page gets to generate one link. The idea being that on the web, you have sort of a finite budget for links you can make, but an unlimited budget for links you can receive. And so you get to make one link at a time, and you can either link to a page completely at random, like the previous model did, or you can find another page randomly and then follow its link. And this had this nice property that pages that already have a lot of links are likely to receive more links. So it exhibits what we called a rich get richer phenomenon. And this sort of rich get richer phenomenon is exactly what leads to these Powell or degree distributions. So if people who already have lots of friends are likely to get more friends, if web pages that already receive a lot of links are likely to get even more links, that's going to lead to this kind of realistic, real-world degree distribution. And this is a log-log plot, but all this is really saying is that you have some degree distribution that looks like that. Okay, so that's kind of how far we got with random graph models. We saw this random network, which is not very realistic, but it's sort of a good starting point to study how real-world social networks look and how they differ from random graphs. And secondly, we saw this idea of a power law. We had this sort of intuitive, high-level notion of this rich-get-richer phenomenon, and we tried to build a random model of networks that exhibited that phenomenon, which then leads to a power law degree distribution. So there's still a lot more to do in terms of random models of networks. I'll get through at least 3 and 4 today, I think, and maybe we can look at hubs and authorities and PageRank next week. But two more ideas that real social networks have that we don't have yet with these random models is one is something like an idea of triangles. So when you form connections, you don't form them randomly. You don't quite just say, well, I'm going to try and connect myself to the most popular person, which is what the second model might do. But you tend to form connections with friends of friends. So when you form connections in social networks, you're kind of closing triangles. So we need to come up with a richer notion where we're looking at not just edges and degrees, but we're looking at triangles in network as well. And kind of the motivation for this is this idea called the strength of weak ties, which is this fun, very old case study where they said, where do people tend to find new jobs? They tend to find them through their acquaintances or their weak ties rather than their close friends. And finally, we'll sort of analyze more rigorously this idea of a small world phenomenon, and we'll try to come up with network models that give rise to this and explain why it happens in social networks. Okay, so, yeah, everything we've looked at so far, these two random graph models, the one, the really random one, and the one that's exhibiting the rich get richer phenomenon, we're still sort of trying to characterize networks in terms of their connectivity patterns, so just in terms of nodes, edges, and node degrees. And we'd like to do something a little bit richer by looking at triangles or looking at triplets. So this is kind of the case study that led to this back in 1973. Granovetter formed this basic survey where he'd say to people, last time you found the job, did you find it through a complete stranger, a close friend, or an acquaintance? So who thinks acquaintance? I mean, from their own experience, no one. Who thinks close friend? Even less than no one. Complete stranger? All right, we've got two hands for acquaintance, none for complete stranger, and none for close friend. So, you know, many, many, many more people seem to agree with this. Anyway, that was the outcome of Granovetter's survey. It seems maybe a little bit funny. Maybe it's unintuitive. Like, you'd think your close friends are people who want to help you. Why is it that nobody says their close friends help them to get a job? Presumably they're not like your adversaries, but the argument might go, well, your close friends are kind of the same as you in terms of their role in the network. They share the same information. They can't tell you anything you don't already know. They wouldn't help you get a job because any job they know about, you would have just gotten yourself. Whereas an acquaintance, that is a person who connects you to a distant part of the network. An acquaintance somehow exposes you to new information. Therefore, somehow they're going to be more likely to tell you something you didn't know that's going to help you. So this is called the strength of weak ties. That's what Granovetter chose to call it. Essentially, weak ties are people like acquaintances, or they're weak ties in the sense that they connect you loosely to a distant part of the network, and weak ties are strong in the sense that they expose you to new information, or, I don't know, they help you find a job. So one of Granovetter's papers was actually called Getting a Job About This Result, which I think is a bit of a silly name, but okay. Anyway, the point is, if we want to study this idea, he saw this idea through a survey, we'd like to come up with some network model that can explain this idea and test this intuition of whether it is true that our acquaintances expose us to new information more than our friends can. So to do this, we're going to need some kind of notion of tie strength in a network, which might measure whether an individual is a close friend or an acquaintance. And we also need to look at how edges in a network sort of change the network's connectivity. So is an edge one that exposes us to different parts of the network we weren't exposed to before? So if we can come up with some sort of meaningful measure of those two things, we can kind of test Granovetter's hypothesis and see if there are some structural properties of networks that explain why it might be acquaintances rather than close friends that expose us to new information. Okay, so firstly, there's this notion of triadic closure. So if a social network looks like this and C is looking to form a new friendship, which of these two is more likely to happen? Are they going to make friends with D or are they going to make friends with B? B. I mean, it should be pretty unanimous, I guess. So B, why? Because it closes a triad. But really, B, because B is a friend of a friend. So, I mean, D is a friend of a friend of a friend, but that's a sort of very loose connection. There's somehow, intuitively, you'd think people are more likely to form friendships with people who are their friends of friends already. There are a bunch of reasons this could happen. This idea has been studied since forever. You know, if two people have a friend in common, it's more likely that they will become friends at some point in the future. It seems pretty obvious. You make friends with friends of friends. Why does this happen? So one is this, you have an opportunity. So C might become friends with B just because that friend of a friend relationship gives them an opportunity to meet. Maybe they show up at the same party that A organized or something like that. So yeah, you're just exposed more frequently to friends and friends in networks because of that repeated exposure. That might be a reason that friendship would form. Second reason is that there might be some kind of trust relationship. So you might think in this network, well, C trusts A because they're friends. A trusts B because they're friends. So C has some reason to trust B. It's like trust relationships might be transitive. Okay, so C has a reason to trust B. They have less of a reason to trust D. I mean, that trust relationship eventually runs out. The third reason, which I think is maybe the most interesting one, is that if C doesn't become friends with B, that creates stress in the network, or it creates stress in their relationship with A. I mean, you know, if you have a good friend, but you refuse to become friends with their friends, then that's a very stressful situation, isn't it? And the more such mutual friends you have, if there's C and B, and some huge number of mutual friends, and yet these two individuals still refuse to become friends, that's going to be very, very, it's going to be stressful for all of their friends, you know. If two people in your social network are, for some reason, enemies with each other, that's very stressful. There's a very nice study, which I'll link to later, at the end of the slides, which actually says it tried to measure signals of whether people are you know, suffering from depressive symptoms based on the extent to which their network looks like this. So people will be very sad if they kind of have enemies who are very good friends with all of their friends. Kind of makes sense, right? So you want to form this friendship just to resolve that stress. It's a good reason for these two to kind of put whatever's troubling them beside them and make up. All right, so I don't think it's too hard to convince you of. People like to close triangles. We can come up with some nice measurement which says what is the extent to which people have a tendency towards closing triangles when they make friends versus forming friends with whoever, whether it closes a triangle or not. So to do this, we can come up with some measure which is called the clustering coefficient for every node I, and it's really saying what is the fraction of pairs of friends of I that are also mutual friends. Okay, so to do that, we sum over all neighbors of I. We're actually summing over all neighbors J and K, so two neighbors at a time. So you know, here's I, here's J, here's K, and we're just asking for what fraction of these pairs does that edge exist or not, divided by the total number of such edges that could exist. So the number of friends they have multiplied by the number of friends they have minus one. So this is going to take a value between 0 and 1. If it's 0, the node is basically a star. None of their friends are friends with each other. If it's 1, the node is sort of the center of a clique. All of their friends are friends with each other. You know, their friends form a complete graph with them. So really, it's basically a measure of the tendency of that person to form friendships that close triangles. And we can measure the same thing about an entire graph. We can just average over the clustering coefficients of individual nodes. That gives us the clustering coefficient of a graph. And that says, in this entire graph, what is the tendency of people to close triangles when they make friends? So you can measure it as defined on the previous slide. Intuitively, all that's going on is this, is that we're counting triangles in the graph that are closed and triangles that are open, and we're saying what fraction of all triangles are closed triangles. So if 100% of triangles are closed, we have a clustering coefficient of 1. If 100% of triangles are open, they look like this, and no one ever closes triangles, we have a clustering coefficient of 0. And our argument is that real-world social networks should have high clustering coefficients. Okay, that's one definition. That's just about the tendency of people in real-world social networks to close triangles. The next definition we need is this idea of a local bridge, or a bridge, first of all. So a bridge is somehow a person who, or it's a connection that exposes us to new information. So an edge BC is a bridge. If removing it would leave no path between B and C. So C is somehow a user who exposes B to a new network, and B is also correspondingly a user who exposes C to a new network. So these are kind of the, these are kind of those, if we think about it, acquaintances who, C is an acquaintance of B maybe who might, that might be the person who helps B find a job and vice versa because they expose him to something new. So those are the two ideas we kind of wanted to capture. We kind of wanted to capture this idea of closing triangles when we make friends. So it's very unlikely that two good friends of mine would not eventually meet each other. And we have this idea of bridges being people who expose us to new information in the network. Yeah. So, yeah, I'll come back to that in a second. So there'll be a nice theorem connecting bridges and triangles, basically. Okay, that's a bridge. Bridge maybe is too strict a notion. If you look at a real social network like Facebook, there are certainly no bridges, right? There's no one edge we could delete from Facebook that would make Facebook into two connected components. But we can think of a local bridge by looking at, so B and C is a local bridge. If you look at B's social network other than C, and we look at C's social network other than B, and if if B connect is the only edge connecting those two local social networks, then we'll call it a local bridge. Doesn't matter that there's some sort of long-range connection where, you know, C and I are distant cousins and connected to F or whatever. So it's not quite as strict a notion as a bridge, but it's saying this is a connection that would separate these two people's immediate social networks. So we're going to say that local bridges are maybe the people who help you get a job, because bridges is too strict. Okay, so this brings us to the theorem that Granovetter wanted to provide. He said, well, it's our acquaintances that are the ones who are exposing us to the information that helps us get a job. How can we relate this idea of triangles closing and local bridges to some property of these networks, and explain why these local bridges must be acquaintances rather than close friends? And what he came up with was this thing called the triadic closure property, which is an assumption you can make about networks, which basically says it's a way of sort of defining a strong tie or a weak tie, so like a good friend or an acquaintance. And he said, if B has strong ties to A and C, then they must also have at least a weak tie. A and C must also have at least a weak tie between them. So, you know, if your best friends are A and C, then it's very likely that those two people must at least know each other, that they must at least be acquaintances with each other. So he's saying, because of the tendency for people to close triangles in networks, if two people are really good friends, they should at least be acquaintances with each other. So that's an assumption he made about networks, and if you accept that assumption to be true, then his theorem says that if that assumption is satisfied, then any local bridges must be acquaintances. They couldn't be close friends. So the proof is pretty simple by contradiction. Let's assume that this connection was, which is a local bridge, let's assume that it was one of your close friends. Well, but then B is friends with C, B is also friends with E, but C and E must have been at least acquaintances. There must have been some connection between them, which would mean this wouldn't be a local bridge anymore, because there must have been some other edge connecting them. So I don't know if the proof's too hand-wavy for you or not, but the idea is basically simple. He's saying that if you accept this assumption, which says that if you're very good friends with two people, those two people must at least be acquaintances. If you accept that assumption, then any local bridge in the network could only be an acquaintance relationship. So if you buy his triadic closure assumption, which I think is pretty reasonable, which says people like to close triangles, then people who expose you to new parts of the network must not be very strong ties. Okay? I think it's not too unreasonable. It's a nice theorem. He had sort of some survey to back it up, but I think maybe a more interesting result is to say, can we see how this plays out empirically on some real social network data set where we can measure not just the social network, but also kind of measure the extent to which two people in that network are good friends versus acquaintances. So there's a beautiful study that was used to do this, which is on mobile phone calls. I forget which country's mobile phone calls they managed to obtain. I don't even know that they say in the paper where the data comes from, but whatever. Some mobile phone company gave them their call record data. So they could see a couple of things. They could see what is the social network of phone calls between people, and they could also see how frequently are these people calling each other, which gives them a measure of not just what the network looks like, but also for every pair of individuals, are they very close friends or not. So the first thing they want to measure is to what extent is a person like a local bridge in a network. So these two people, I and J, they talk to each other. We can measure the extent to which they have similar sets of friends. And we'll do that just using the Jaccard similarity. We remember that from our recommender system slide. We're just measuring the amount of intersection between their two sets of friends. So it's going to be 0 if they have completely disjoint sets of friends. It's going to be 1 if these two people fulfill exactly the same role in their networks and have exactly the same set of friends. Okay? So this is kind of measuring the extent to which an edge is a bridge edge. So if the overlap will be 0, that's sort of truly what Granovetter defined as being a local bridge. We sort of have something smooth between very bridgy edges and very non-bridgy edges sort of connect to very similar or very different networks. Okay, so that's our measure of local bridginess. The other measure they come up with is just the tie strength, which all they do is say how frequently do these two people call each other. A strong tie are two people who make very many phone calls to each other. A weak tie are two people who hardly ever call each other. And to test Granovetter's theorem, what they'd like to say is that if two people are, if their connection is this sort of local bridge type connection, they must not be very good friends. Yeah, a local bridge must be between acquaintances. Therefore, these two people shouldn't be calling each other very often. And the data seems to support this really nicely. This is just a graph of, I mean, the cumulative tie strength is just a ranked list for every pair of people who talked. These are the two people who talked the least frequently. These are the two people who talked the most frequently, however frequently that actually is, versus the overlap, so versus the tie strength. So, tie strength versus the overlap. And it just says, yeah, the less the overlap is, and the more local bridgy they are, the lower the tie strength also is. So it seems that local bridges correspond to acquaintance-like relationships. So pretty nice sort of verification of Granovetter's theorem. Another one, more recently, was done on Facebook. The idea here was to see, you know, under what conditions are you likely to accept an email invite from Facebook? Does anyone ever remember getting invited to Facebook by email? Did anyone join Facebook that way? Maybe, year one, okay. I guess probably LinkedIn you joined by email. So, you know, some of these social networks, the other members can send out invitation emails. And Facebook wanted to measure the probability of adoption. So the idea here is kind of nice. If you receive 4 email invites from Facebook, under what condition would you be more likely to become a Facebook member? Maybe you'll accept the invites if 4 of your very good friends invite you. Maybe if 4 distant acquaintances invited you, you'd be less likely than if 4 good friends invited you. But what about if, you know, you got a combination? You've got 1 friend invited you, 1 family member invited you, 1 work colleague invited you, maybe 1 of your acquaintances invited you. Okay, so what would be consistent with Granovetter's theorem is that in the latter case, you would treat this as 4 separate pieces of evidence that Facebook was good. That would make you more likely to accept it. Whereas this is just, it's the same thing 4 times. So you don't really treat that as being more significant than 1 friend inviting you. Which, of course, is nice for Facebook. It means they can sort of reduce the number of invites they have to send you while maximizing the probability that you'll actually accept them. Okay, so the way they did this was to take some user who was invited to Facebook, and they can see, you know, when they eventually joined years later or whatever, what did their social network eventually look like, and then these are the 4 users who invited them. And what they thought was, well, if you get invited by 4 distinct groups of people, that would make you more likely to accept than if you got invited by 4 very similar people. So they took the network of your friends. So think of this same social network, but delete you from the middle because you're not on Facebook yet. And then of the people invite you, draw the connections between them. So these two are connected, but out of the sort of 6 possible connections, none of the other ones exist. So they said this is kind of like 3 distinct groups of people inviting you to Facebook. These two people are both friends with each other, so they're kind of from your perspective, they're the same. And they said, is the number of distinct groups going to impact the probability that a person joins Facebook, right? So in the simplest case, you just got two invitations to Facebook, and there are only two cases to consider. Did you get two invitations from people who know each other, or did you get two invitations from people who don't know each other? And what they show is that you're much more likely to accept the invitation if the two people who invited you don't know each other already. So 1.0 here is the probability that you would accept an invite from just one person. And then if you get two invites, but they're from people who both know each other, you're only fractionally more likely to accept the invitation, which kind of says, yeah, you're just getting a second piece of information that you already knew. But if two people who don't know each other both invite you, you become basically twice as likely to accept the invitation. And they can do this for various other numbers of invitations too. So if you've got three invitations, how does this contact neighborhood impact your likelihood of adoption? So if it's three people who all know each other, as in the first two cases, it only slightly increases your chance of accepting. If they form two distinct groups, it doubles your chance. And if they form three distinct groups, it's like 2.5x as likely. And then things get sort of more zany when you have four people inviting you. I mean, I think there were sort of class action lawsuits getting linked in recently for this kind of thing. But anyway, I mean, you have, I guess, 11 types of contact neighborhood. The first six of them, everyone's connected. So they kind of form a single group around 1.0. Four invitations don't make you any more likely to accept than one would. And then the next three neighborhoods correspond to two distinct groups of people, which makes you sort of 1.5 to 2 times more likely. And then three and four distinct groups of people make you even more likely again. So it's a pretty nice confirmation that these distinct groups of people are exposing you to distinct or independent pieces of information. One other funny thing here is the huge error bars on this type of contact neighborhood. Basically, this shape just never happens in social network data. I think you can imagine all of your friends and friends of friends. Try to imagine any of them that are connected in this shape. It would just be very weird, wouldn't it? Okay. All right. So that's about all I wanted to say, I think, about strong and weak ties and getting a job or whatever it is. But basically, we have this basic idea that says when you make friendships, you tend to close triangles. And we can sort of measure this with something like a clustering coefficient and say to what extent is it true in any given network that people like to close triangles. And we made this argument that edges that connect distinct parts of the network must somehow be weak connections, and yet they expose us to distinct sources of information. Okay, so something else I didn't get to, which I'll give some links from, it's kind of fun, is all of this is assuming that relationships in the network correspond to friendships. So you like to close triangles with friends of friends. A bunch of other different things can happen if you also have enemy relationships, which exist on a few social networks besides Facebook. I think, anyone name one as enemies? I think there's Hatebook. But there are a few, anyway. I mean, there's a nice one about, it's not a public network, but Wikipedia adminship elections. There's this nice network data saying who voted for and against whom to become a Wikipedia admin, so that's kind of like a network where you have both friends and enemies. And you can come up with a similar notion that people like to form friendships with enemies of their enemies, but they're unlikely to be enemies with friends of their friends, and they're unlikely to be enemies with enemies of their enemy. So there's some nice sort of structural balance theory that can explain that. Okay, but that's about all I wanted to say about triads. Is that all pretty clear? Hopefully it's super clear, because we all belong to social networks. It should mimic our own experience. The final thing I wanted to cover is this idea of the small world phenomenon. So can we come up with network models which kind of explain why small worlds exist. So we have a model that exhibits power laws, which is one realistic aspect of a social network. But we haven't checked at all yet whether our random models of network formation, whether they close the correct number of triangles, like we've just seen, and whether they correctly exhibit small world phenomena. So I'll spend a while talking about small world phenomena, and then I'll say, how can we come up with an algorithm that does the two things we talked about today, that closes triangles and that exhibits small worlds. Okay, so, you know, you remember the small world phenomenon from Monday, and you probably played this game, 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon, where you want to trace co-acting roles in movies back to Kevin Bacon. So, you know, Kevin Bacon is Kevin Bacon. Jack Lemmon is sort of one hop from Kevin Bacon because they were in JFK, and then Kevin Spacey's two hops from Kevin Bacon because they were in Dad. And you can play this game with your friend, name any actor, and try to get back to Kevin Bacon in as few hops as possible. And, you know, any actor, if you're good enough at this game, can be traced back to Kevin Bacon, really and truly. So, you know, this is not a new idea. This has sort of anecdotally been known since forever. The first person to study this was Stanley Milgram. You know, people already knew that there seemed to exist these short paths between people on social networks. He wanted to say, well, how long are those paths actually, and can people find them? So this is the experiment he conducted. He would take somehow a random pair of users with start points in Omaha and Wichita, which I guess is sort of far from everything, and then some endpoint in Boston. And he'd say, you have to forward letters to this person in Boston, but you're only allowed to forward them via people you know directly. And you want to forward them such that somehow they'll get closer to the endpoint. I mean, not closer in the geographical sense necessarily, but closer in sort of the social network sense. You want to forward them to friends who you think are fewer hops away than you are to the target, or if you know the target, you can forward it directly, of course. So either they sent it directly if they knew the target, or they wrote their name on it, forwarded it to the next person. So once it reached the target, you could see all of the hops that it took and how far the original person was from the target. All right. Also, every time a letter was sent, one would be sent in parallel back to the researchers just so they could trace how far the letters that didn't make it actually got, where they died out. And also confirm, you know, there's no super long path of letters that's still going to this day. Okay, so the finding is simple. It's just, this is where the expression 6 degrees of separation comes from. They found that the average path length was between 5.5 and 6 letters before it reached the destination. So a couple of things are kind of remarkable. First, it just confirms that short paths are abundant. So these are small worlds. There do exist short paths between people who have absolutely no reason to know each other. But the second more interesting thing is that human beings are capable of finding these paths in a decentralized fashion. Like, it's not an online social network where you can see the graph. These people have no idea what the graph looks like beyond their own friends, yet somehow they're able to intelligently route a letter toward the other individual. So it's like a decentralized way of solving a shortest path problem. And people are somehow good at doing this. So kind of anecdotally, Milgram found that people tend to sort of start by using geography. If you have to get a letter to someone in Boston, you'll first just say, well, I don't know anyone in Boston, but I know someone in Pennsylvania. That's close to Boston. Maybe they'll know someone in Boston. So you use geography for a few hops. Then it would kind of end up somewhere around Boston for a little while and kind of get lost. And then I think a lot of letters ended up with, I think it was a laundromat owner or something, like a person who had incredibly high degree in the network and was able to sort of close a lot of these letters. But anyway, people have some kind of heuristic they can use to estimate the number of hops in the network, and it seems to work pretty well. But really, this is saying the bound on the path distance is 5.5 or 6. The shortest paths must be no larger than that, but they could actually be much smaller. So that's in social networks. This kind of thing shows up all over the place. Another case that people like to talk about is the Erdős number. So this is Paul Erdős's co-authorship network. These are all people he's published with or who've published with each other. So Erdős has an Erdős number of zero. Apparently he's written papers with 504 people. I don't know, maybe they just put Erdős's name on the paper and he didn't mind. Not sure. And then they have an Erdős number of one. People who published with them have an Erdős number of two. And, you know, if you've written any paper about anything, you probably have an Erdős number of kind of four, five, six, or seven. Your Erdős number sort of cannot be very large just because of the way collaboration networks form. So who do we know with an Erdős number of one? At least two at UCSD. They're like super famous. You should all know them. Ron Graham, yes. Who else? What's her name? Fan Chung. Okay, yes, spectral graph theory and so forth. So here's Ron Graham, here's Fan Chung, here's Paul Erdős. I think they're on holiday together or something. This picture actually was drawn by Ron Graham in what appears to be crayon, I guess. So, you know, obviously, these people were all very close to each other. Okay, that's the Erdős number. Of course, there's also the Bacon number. This is just a distribution of actors' Bacon numbers. Pretty much any actor is going to have a Bacon number of three or four, so it just can't be that large. The intersection of these things, there's the Erdős Bacon number. Natalie Portman was, I guess, a graduate student at some point, or maybe she published as an undergrad, I don't know. Not under the name Natalie Portman, I forget what her name really is. But she has a Bacon number of two, she has an Erdős number of five, and then there's this idea called it's a very silly idea, called a Bacon-Erdős number, which is I think it's the max of these two things. This is her in the film Thor, where she was actually playing a graduate student. So things have really come full circle for her. All right, so that was the Milgram experiment, where he was trying to just get people in a decentralized fashion to send letters to each other. There have been some updates on this idea since then. This is the same thing brought to the 21st century with emails. Exactly the same study. You want to reach one of 18 targets, no longer just someone in Boston, and they would email some huge number of people. 24,133 chains were started, and they have to forward emails to one of these targets in a bunch of different countries. Kind of alarmingly, only 384 emails out of 24,000 made it. I guess compared to like a traditional letter, if you get a forwarded email telling you to forward it to someone else so that it can eventually be forwarded to someone who you don't know, I don't know, you're probably pretty likely to just delete it. So they had to do a pretty large-scale study to come up with a pretty small-scale result. They essentially confirmed the same thing. With email, the shortest path lengths are, or the sort of decentralized path lengths are, even lower, only about four steps. I guess you just have a larger list of email contacts than you have a set of friends you'd be willing to write a letter to. What's more interesting about this study is they actually asked people, when they forwarded an email, why they forwarded an email to that person. So they can kind of figure out what is the decentralized routing algorithm that people are using to try and estimate these path distances. So they could say, okay, you're this far along in the email chain. What heuristic are you going to use to try and send the email to the target? And they ask people like, I'm going to send it to the next hop because this person is in a similar location or a nearby location to the target, or they've traveled to a location similar to the target, or their family members might know the target, or so on and so forth. And the basic finding is that for the first few hops, people have a large tendency to make their routing decisions based on geography, but as you get further down, people tend to use things like, oh, do they work in the same company together or something like that. So that's cute. Finally, just kind of closing out the topic, this has been done on real-world social networks where you can actually see the graph. So you're no longer asking humans, can you forward an email efficiently? But you're just saying, well, I have the whole network. Okay, so you know the topology of the entire network. You can just directly measure what is the shortest path if people knew how to route things perfectly. Okay, so presumably this number is a bit lower than what humans could obtain. So this is Facebook. I mean, this is just the degree distribution. So 50% is the median. So it's something like you have 1 or 200 friends on Facebook, and routing things through those links, you find across the whole world hop lengths of about 5. So shortest path lengths between people of about 5. And if you just look at the US, they're about 4. So pretty similar numbers. It seems like the real shortest path between people is not much lower than what people get when they try and solve this with a decentralized algorithm. Okay, one other funny thing here, which I won't get to until sort of week 10 when we talk about temporal dynamics, is they actually computed this property as Facebook got older and older, so across 3 years of Facebook. And in 2011, the hop distance was about 1 point smaller than it was in 2008. So obviously Facebook got bigger and bigger and bigger, but the distance between people got smaller and smaller and smaller. So this is a pretty unintuitive result. You would kind of naturally think, well, as the network gets bigger, people must somehow become more distant. Doesn't happen. The opposite happens. It's that the network gets bigger, somehow people get even closer to each other. We'll kind of see why in 2 weeks. Not now. All right, so we wanted to come up with some model that would explain these things, right? We wanted to have a random network model where people like to close triangles and where small world phenomena exist. So we haven't really looked at those things in our random network models yet. We have this sort of Erdős-Rényi random graph, which is the most naive thing. But funnily enough, this does exhibit small world phenomena. So if you think you would join Facebook or everyone would join Facebook and just randomly connect to 100 people, then you'd have 100 friends. You'd have 100 times 100 friends of friends because they're just branching out completely at random. Then you'd have sort of 10 to the 6th friends of friends of friends. You'd have 10 to the 8 friends of friends of friends of friends. And everyone, you get to 10 billion then, everyone would be a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend, right? So even this trivial model we started with on Monday, that would exhibit small world phenomena. It's obviously not a very realistic way of social networks forming, but it does exhibit small worlds, which is realistic. On the other hand, well, I just said people like to close triangles. They have an extreme tendency to close triangles in networks. So you're not just randomly branching out to very distant connections, but you're only connecting to people who you are almost connected to anyway. Yeah, so if all you do is form friendships between friends of friends, you're not really making the path lengths in the networks any shorter. So if all you did was close triangles, you would not have small worlds. You know, you'd end up with just increasingly dense cliques of disconnected people, you know, like grade school or something. And this is certainly true on Facebook. It's the vast majority of cases, people close triangles. So 92% of friendships formed on Facebook are closing a triangle, so they're connecting a friend of a friend. All right, so I don't know why I have this slide. It's just a definition. Basically, what we're talking about with small worlds is what's called network diameter. So we're talking about longest, shortest path distance in a network. And we'd like to come up with a random graph model such that people close triangles like they do in real life, but such that longest, shortest path distances are small. All this nonsense here is just saying, well, we're not really going to compute longest, shortest path distances. That's very expensive. What we'd really like is, on average, if you pick a random pair of nodes, the path length should be short. So this is called, I mean, you can read this in your own time when you've got an hour or two free. What we really care about is, it's sort of something like 90th percentile of shortest path distances. So pick a million pairs of nodes at random. You'd like 90% of them to have short paths. That's what we're going to call small worldness. We're saying that on average, shortest path distances should be short. And, you know, if we had this random graph model, then it would just take log n steps, where n is the size of the network, and the base of the logarithm is the degree. It would take log n steps to reach everyone. Yeah? So it would exhibit small worlds in that sense. So there are kind of two ends of the spectrum. There's random networks, which are very small worldy. Everyone can reach everyone within a few hops, but they're not very triangular. Yeah? There's no tendency in a random network of people to close triangles rather than forming any other connection. So that's unrealistic for this reason. On the other end of the spectrum, you can imagine, I mean, no social network is going to look like this, but this one would be very triangular. Every edge belongs to a huge number of triangles. So it's a realistic social network in that sense, but there are really long paths between nodes if you made a large lattice graph. So this is very small worldy but non-triangular. This is very triangular but non-small worldy. So these are kind of two opposite ends of the spectrum that are both equally unrealistic as social networks. But a simple random graph model that would exhibit both lots of triangles and small worlds is going to be something in between that. So we'd like to come up with some random graph model that has the good property of this and the good property of this and the bad property of neither. So it has lots of triangles, but it also has small diameter. So the first model that was proposed for this is a very, very simple one. We just start with a lattice, so a triangular network with lots of triangles, where you just talk to your neighbors or your neighbor's neighbors. But it's got very long, shortest paths, and you just introduce some randomness into it. So with some probability p, you just rewire an edge at random. And, you know, you can do that. You can kind of then get this continuum between a completely triangular and a completely small world graph, but hopefully somewhere in the middle there's a graph that kind of has both things. And the main result in this paper is that if you set p correctly, then, yeah, you do get small worlds with high clustering coefficients. So I won't give the proof of that because there's a much, much simpler model that someone came up with later, which is the same idea. You start with a lattice graph, so lots of triangles, high clustering coefficient, and you just add a random link. Each node randomly connects to someone else. So that doesn't really change your clustering coefficient by too much, but it adds enough randomness into the graph that there are now short connections between everyone. And the sort of easy way to see this is to think, well, let's treat each set of four nodes here as being like a supernode, and then on the bottom level, the red level, if you like, I've got a graph with high clustering coefficient, and then on the turquoise level, I've got a graph with small worlds. So to find a short path between two people, I've just got to move up to the turquoise graph, follow a link, and then I'm in the right supernode, and I just have to move one step. Okay, so this very simple model, which is just a random graph laid on top of a lattice graph, is going to exhibit both high clustering coefficient and the small world phenomena. So it looks a bit funny, but in that sense, it's kind of a realistic recreation of a social network. Okay, so I think that's all I wanted to say about random graph models. We have a few things now. We've talked about power laws, we've talked about clustering coefficients and triangles, and we've talked about the small world phenomenon. The model I just showed is going to exhibit high clustering coefficients in small worlds, so it's realistic in that sense. Unfortunately, it doesn't lead to the right degree distributions, so the rich get richer or the preferential attachment model did, so I gave you one model that has good degree distributions and one model that has clustering coefficients in small worlds. I didn't give you everything. For that, you're going to have to look up some kind of unreadable paper. But there is this nice random algorithm out there that will give you small worlds, clustering coefficient, and power law degree distributions. All right, so what are we up to? We've seen the small world phenomenon. We've seen this idea of a clustering coefficient. Initially, these seem to be kind of at odds with each other, because if all you do is close triangles, you're not going to create small worlds. All we had to do this was start with a highly clustered network and add a few random connections. And, you know, kind of that's not too different from how people really form social networks. Most of the time, or 92% of the time on Facebook, you form friendships with friends of friends. Occasionally, you just sit next to someone on a plane and then connect to them on Facebook afterwards, right? So as long as you do that 8% of the time, then that's going to be enough to guarantee that we have both high clustering and small world phenomena. Okay, so there's loads and loads and loads of references to follow up on about on that. I think I'll stop talking about social networks and say a little bit more about assignment two, to say what are some of the interesting things that people attempted last quarter. So hopefully you get an idea of what's expected. Of course, these are the best ones. Hopefully you can do even better. And certainly, there is a tendency here for me to have selected people's assignments if they had some kind of good-looking plot. It's not compulsory to have a good-looking plot. If you'd like me to talk about your assignment in class, it definitely helps. So lots of people studied wine data. This was a fun one where the person's goal was to build a recommender system that would tell you the optimal age to drink a wine. And they looked at a bunch of rating data over time to do that. The annoying thing they found was that the ratings just kept getting higher and higher and higher. We all know that wine eventually turns to vinegar. So there's something wrong with this. Or perhaps people just aren't bothering to enter ratings once the wine has become vinegar. But what they did instead then is said, could they find this inflection point where the rating doesn't decrease, but at least it stops increasing by so much? And that would be a nice way of recommending not that a wine is necessarily past it, but that it's not going to get any better if you keep it for longer. More stuff about wines. People looked at the linguistics and the temporal information. This is just a nice plot showing how ratings vary at different times of year. Maybe people are particularly unhappy during the middle of the year and they really like wine at the beginning and the end. If people write, peer review length is an extremely strong indicator of the rating, so people are very, they have lots to write, they're very gushing if they like a wine. Lots of stuff with sentiment analysis and Wordles, so very, pretty much straightforward applications of everything from week 7, I guess, and homework 4 if you feel like doing that. They're trying to come up with sort of unigram or bags of words models that say if sentiment is positive or negative. You know, you use words like unbelievable and perfection if a wine is good, and vile and yuck if a wine is bad, and orgasm and apparently video if beer is good, and undrinkable and vile if beer is bad. I really don't know what's going on here with 7/8 and probably a few outliers got into the data set there. And Wiener as well. There was some really nice sort of geospatial stuff. So I mentioned on Monday this big Google Local data set of, and similarly the Yelp data set, which has ratings and geographical coordinates and temporal information and price and users and so on and so forth. A couple of ways people tried to deal with this. One is to say, well, let's try and model the notion of a local taste. So people might rate things differently in different locations. Of course, there's, you know, you don't want to just use the latitude and longitude coordinates directly, as we learned from the midterm, but maybe you'd like to do some clustering on the locations of businesses and say each cluster has its own term in the model which says how people rate things in that region or something like that. and it's actually pretty significant. This is just a biased term. It's pretty significant, like half-star rating variation between different areas. People in, I don't know, North Dakota or something, just nasty. And other similar ways of doing this. This was another one. It's also trying to build a sort of latent factor recommender system, but rather than using clustering, they tried to use the geographical coordinates as a kind of regularizer. So they said people's ratings should be similar to other businesses that are nearby. So they looked at the rating models of their nearest neighbors. And there was also some nice NLP stuff using the same data. Fun one was Wikipedia. So this is that sort of Kevin Bacon game, but on Wikipedia. You're given two Wikipedia pages, and you have to find the shortest path between them by following Wikipedia links. We've all done this. There's a game that gamifies it, and they analyzed essentially the strategies people use to solve this sort of decentralized routing problem on Wikipedia. It turns out to be actually pretty similar to the way you would forward letters to people. You start by trying to find very generic topics before you hone back down. I guess this is something between asteroids and Vikings, or who knows what. And yeah, other things that I never would have thought of. I mean, some people collected their own data, which is definitely bonus points. So these people were trying to do regression models of image popularity on Chictopia using like tags and social features and content. Okay, so I think that's all I wanted to say about assignment two. One last thing. Assignment one should be very quick to mark since it's largely based on your leaderboard position, and the TAs are marking their reports as we speak. So I should be able to tell you pretty much the grades for everything except for homework four and assignment two by the end of this week. So you should, and I'll talk about the grading scheme, which I promise will be very generous. So you should know pretty soon whether you need to do homework four or not. If so, it's due on Monday.
This has been a UC San Diego podcast. For more, visit podcast.ucsd.edu.